This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Hi. Just before Dreamland starts, I have good news and bad news. The good news is it's an incredible Dreamland. The bad news is, and maybe this is because it involves the afterlife. This happens often. Its video quality is really horrible, and we can't fix it. And I do not want to try to do this interview again because special things happened, and I'm not willing to try to sort of force that. So you can hear it perfectly. It's not a problem with the audio, but the video is definitely inferior, and it had something to do with our recording studio on StreamYard. I have no idea what it was, and neither do they at this point. They have not answered my query. I'm sure they will, but unfortunately, it is what it is. Anyway, get set for an incredible edition of Dreamland. I get many, many books sent to me, many people asking to be interviewed on Dreamland. Every once in a while, something truly exceptional comes in, and we're going to be talking to someone who sent in something truly exceptional and has a truly exceptional life to talk about in just a minute. Let me read a paragraph from the book. I opened it at random, and this is what I first read. It was on our return journey that it happened. I glanced up, expecting nothing more than the endless expanse of blue sky. Instead, I was met with an extraordinary sight. A metallic saucer, unmistakably a UFO, hovering silently above us. Its surface was smooth and reflective, almost blending into the sky, but for the faint dark halo that seemed to surround it. Now, wait until you hear the rest of this story. It is not what you think. This is a story about life and death and more, and UFOs, of course. I want to introduce you to Matt Hendrick. Matt, welcome to Dreamland.
Hey, Whitley, how you doing?
Well, fine, thank you. I'm very, very glad that you're here. In a lot of ways, because you just almost missed me in here altogether. Matt has written a book called Uncommon Vision, and I want to start at the beginning, and we're going to go through this amazing story together. Matt, let's go back to St. Louis, to your grandma's house, and to a certain tape. You tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was when I was eight or 9 years old, around that time. And I went to St. Louis to my grandmother's house with my mom. And she had gone to a psychic, and there was this tape that she had, a cassette tape. This was in the 80s. And she was bringing it to my grandma, and they were really excited to listen to it. And I had asked her, can I listen to it? And she said, absolutely not. I was forbidden to hear the information on the tape. So, of course, you know, when I'm just a little kid, I'm like, okay, I'm going to get that tape. And in the middle of the night, I went into her room and unzipped her suitcase and got the cassette and grabbed my grandma's tape recorder, and I went and listened to it. And it was, it was about an hour long, and about halfway through, the psychic says, I see one of your sons in a chair. And my mom says, a chair? And she says, a wheelchair. And my mom's like, well, that must be my younger son, because he's always had some problems with his legs. And the psychic says, no, it's your older son. So when I heard that, I was like, okay, that's the information I'm not supposed to know. And you know, I was just a kid, so I kind of didn't really believe it or thought, you know, like, yeah, right, when I'm 80 or something, I'll be in a wheelchair. So, yeah, that's what happened in St. Louis.
So this is an truly extraordinary event, folks. Truly extraordinary. And we're going to take our first break a little early today because I want there to be no breaks during the telling of this phenomenal story. Free Dreamlanders, we will return. We're talking to Matt Hendrick. His website, hendrickmedia.com. His book, Uncommon Vision. And it's uncommon as it can be, believe me. Okay, let's fast forward now. Let's talk a little bit about your, at this age, the prediction, it had an effect on you, obviously. Tell us about over the years after you heard the tape, how it lingered in your mind, or did it?
It did for a little while, but honestly, I was so wrapped up in sports and just being a kid, you know, just riding my bike, doing BMX and skateboarding, and I kind of forgot about it, to be honest.
Kind of forgot about it, but something didn't forget about you. It wouldn't.
Yeah.
Let's fast forward now to October the 19th, 1991.
Yes.
Rochester Institute of Technology is the setting. Tell us the story.
I was a first year student up there, and my mom came up for, she flew in for parents' weekend. It was, you know, the first 8 weeks, I think it's about 8 weeks into the semester. And, you know, she had told me she's going to pick me up early on Saturday, and we're going to go up to some area around the Finger Lakes up there. I'm not real familiar with that area, but she wanted to go do some touring up there and sightseeing, and she had a bed and breakfast for us. And so, you know, I got in the car and it was raining, and I had told her, you know, I'm not really feeling that good. I'm tired. And I really wanted to just go back to our hotel and sleep. And she insisted that we go. We drove, I got in the passenger seat of the rental car and I leaned it all the way back. And Whitley, do you remember those seatbelts? When you would get in and shut the door, the shoulder belt would automatically come on, and you had to fasten the lap belt yourself.
Yeah, I remember. Sure, absolutely.
It was that type of system, and you know, I was like, okay, shoulder belt's on, good enough, I'm safe. I leaned the seat all the way back, and. And, you know, somewhere along the way, we had gotten an accident. We still don't really know what happened. We went off the road and hit something. And we were only going like 25 miles an hour, but I came around the seatbelt. It flipped me basically. It saved my life, but it also broke my neck at the same time. And I wound up with my head where you would be sitting and my knees down where your feet would go. We hit the passenger side pretty hard. And the next thing I know, people are tapping on the window and asking me if I'm okay. And I'm just telling them that I really just want to sleep. And then I get a bunch of like just little blips, little slideshows, little video clips of what happened for probably the next month. And I had another one where I'm being hoisted up into the helicopter for the flight for life, and the nurse on board telling me, you've been in a really bad accident and your mother's going to a different hospital. By the way, she's okay. She wasn't hurt in the accident, but I wound up in a hospital kind of near Elmira, New York. And then I kind of wake up at one point, and one of the CNAs or caregivers is working on me, and I'm like, you know, I got to get out of here. I got to get back to class. I got homework, and I was really into studying at RIT. And she looks down at my hands and she goes, well, there's a small problem here. And I'm like, what? And she's like,
yeah,
you're paralyzed. That's right. You're paralyzed. So I was like, wait, no, I'm not. You know, and I could move my hand. I felt like I could move my hands, and I was given the command, you know, from my brain to move my hands, and they weren't moving. And, you know, I just kind of get blackout from shock at that point. So, yeah, I had, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm listening.
So I broke my neck, and I became a C5-6 quadriplegic.
Meaning no use of arms or legs.
Oh, actually, quadriplegic is full or partial paralysis in all four limbs. So as a C5-6, I can move my shoulders. I can show you here. Yeah. And I can also move my biceps to bring my arms up, but I have no use of my hands. I have a little bit of wrist function, but I can't move them at all. So
that's rough, man.
Yeah, I mean, it takes
now for how many years?
I'm going into my 33rd year next month, or in October. So
yeah, so this is your life.
Yeah, you know, I've been like this for a long time.
Let's talk now about a near-death experience, because we're building a story here, folks. Remember that quote from the beginning when we started out, we're going to build a long story that's going to go in a lot of different directions, but don't forget that quote of that UFO sighting is central to this story. Okay, let's go now to what happened in terms of your near-death experience.
Okay, yeah. So there was a point. So I'm from Colorado, and they flew me back on a medical jet. And I got to a Swedish hospital here, and they were there was a lot of my friends, a lot of people from high school and college that I knew that, you know, were all there to support me and see me as I, you know, came from the medical jet to the hospital. And it was pretty quick where they wanted to rush me into a surgery to put a halo device on my head. I don't know if you've seen those, but where they drill holes in your forehead and the back of your head and put this real weird looking device on there. It's called a halo. It's pretty horrific. I like to tell people it's not, you know, it stabilizes your head, but all you can do is move your eyes around and stuff. So I think it was during that surgery where all of a sudden I'm going up, you know, tunnel of light that you hear about frequently, and it's very comfortable and inviting and warm, and just there's no sensation, you know, there's no hot, cold, your body doesn't hurt. I just remember going, well, I'm out of my body and I'm free from the problems of the body. And there's a white light at the top, like a circle, and there's three shadows up there, like silhouettes they look like human silhouettes, and the voices, they were talking to me. They're just regular. They sound like regular humans, and they're just encouraging me to, you know, give up. This one's over. You know, there's nothing you can do. Just give in to it. You're welcome to come back up here. And I'm like, wait, I'm not ready. You know, I don't want to go. And they're like, well, you know, you kind of have to. There's no choice here. And so I'm, you know, going straight up and up. And I'm like, but wait a second. Look, have you seen how many hot women are coming to visit me? All the girls from high school and college and stuff. And they laughed. They laughed hard. And all of a sudden I went, zipped right down into my body, back on whatever table I was on. And, you know, I kind of blacked out after that, but that was my first near death experience.
First near death experience. The interesting thing about this experience was it's the opposite of most people, in the sense that you were said, they were saying, you're done. Come on. You're finished. You don't have to do this anymore. And you were saying, no, I'm not ready. I'm going back. And you were, did you know that you were going back to a catastrophically damaged body?
I don't think I realized that. Now,
would you have come back, do you think, if you had known that?
You know, that's a good question, and I'll have to say, I don't think I would go back. After all these years, yeah, I should have went, but...
But you didn't. You came back.
Yeah.
And now here you are, and maybe fulfilling a role that you... you were destined to fulfill in a way.
Yeah.
Even though you could have left.
Uh-huh.
So now, can you sent during the medical flight, this was already sort of beginning to happen, and you felt a sense of detachment, as I recall.
Yes.
Detachment. You knew that you were paralyzed.
Correct, yeah.
And you felt this sense of detachment. And then the next thing you know, you have a NDE. And now, tell us about your mother's role in all of this. I mean, she's had this accident. This terrible thing has happened to her son. How does she react?
Oh, she was, you know, heartbroken. It's the last thing that any mother would want to have happen with their oldest son. And, you know, but that tape, that the psychic thing, we didn't connect the dots for many years after that. But, you know, she basically said she would devote her life to helping me, you know, with getting resources and doing anything we can to repair or find cures and stuff like that. And, you know, we were on it for many years trying to research everything, but after a while, it just becomes normal.
It becomes your normal life.
Yeah.
Now, at this point, you're struggling with this, and you lose everything. Your sense of purpose, horrible adjustment to life as a quadriplegic, and
yeah.
How do you cope with that?
It's not easy. I mean, you know, 1 week I'm in New York and I'm really independent and I'm learning a lot. And I had just met Annie Leibovitz was in one of our classes for teaching us some stuff. I was in the photography program there.
Yeah, Annie Leibovitz is a famous photographer, a wonderful photographer.
Yeah, yeah. She's
also
great.
Also an extremely interesting human being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She gave us a lecture on how to get your subjects to do stuff that they normally wouldn't do. So, you know, I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. So now you're not, obviously, that life is not.
Yeah. It's gone. I'm sitting back. Well, I was in the hospital for 6 months. And then, you know, you're like, I want to go home. I need to go home. As soon as you get home, you're, you know, I'm sitting in my parents' house in their living room. That's the only room that's on the first floor. And now that's my bedroom with a hospital bed and a wood floor in there. And it's a pretty small room. And, you know, I made it through, but I was meeting Annie Leibovitz, and now I'm paralyzed back in my parents' house. That was very hard to deal with.
I can't imagine. Yeah. I'm sure no one can who hasn't dealt with that, and it would be very disingenuous to say, "Oh, yeah, I can imagine that," because I can't. Well, let's go back to the NDE, because there's a lot of energies in this story that are not, you know, like right on the surface, but I want to talk a little bit about the. I'm looking at the book here now on my iPad, and as soon as I picked it up, I lost my place. So you were pulled back. You went back into your body kind of violently.
Yeah.
Yeah. And tell me about I'm trying to get to a question here, and I lost my place. Okay. Once you've had the out of body experience, you begin to sense a new sense of purpose, as if a new kind of energy has come into you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, you feel like you just really want to survive. And you know, a lot of that didn't dawn on me until much later down the road, maybe 6-7 years later.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there's a lot to learn about being a quadriplegic, and they teach you in 3 months, like what would take, you know, like it seems like a 10-year college degree that you get in 3 months. You have to really learn a lot. And you're also dealing with all the psychological stuff, you know, all the, you know, why me? Why couldn't I have just broke my back and been a paraplegic? Why? You know, there's a lot of whys involved, and how, you know, and you start thinking about, you know, how am I ever going to, you know, work again or go to school or, you know, have a relationship, or am I ever going to get married? Can I have kids? You know, your whole frame of mind just changes immediately. So I really had to deal. You have to process some of that. And I think it takes about 5 years. But then, you know, some of the stuff that you're talking about, the, you know, the energies and the, you know, like trying to have a purpose, trying to understand what life is really about, that kind of came about. I got a dog and a cat, and I had a lot of plants, and I just really didn't want to be around people that much. But I really like to be around all that stuff. And I kind of learned, you know, just the, you know, just to learn a different pace of life.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
There was one point at the hospital where a doctor said a rather surprising things to you. The doctor said that there was no reason that you should be paralyzed. Why did he say that?
Yeah, because, well, that was the last day I was in rehab, and he brought me into his office, and he showed me an MRI of my spinal cord. And he goes, you know, he looked at it, and he's like, there is really hardly any damage here. And the way I presented myself with the paralysis, he's like, it's not really matching up how it should. So, he's like, he didn't want to tell me that I would recover, but he kind of thought that I might. He doesn't want to promise anything, but I never did.
Yeah. And yet it's an unusual situation. The spinal cord has not got any clear damage, and yet this happened. It's like your fate in a way. It's a very strange story. When you get beneath the surface of the story, this is more than a story about a guy in an auto accident. And that UFO, we're going to get to that in a few minutes. But before we get there, folks, let's take our break for our Free Dreamlanders. We'll be right back. All right. Now, you have a... let's talk a little bit about the UFO. Tell us about when it was seen and at what context you saw it. And I believe you were not alone.
No, I wasn't alone. And this was in the year 2001. So 10 years after the accident. And I was very adjusted to the injury. And I had bought a Toyota 4Runner that year, and my brother could pick me up and put me in the passenger seat and throw my wheelchair in the back. And my mom had, she had moved down to a ranch in a little bit south of Pueblo in Colorado, and kind of by the San Juan Mountains, a little east of there. And we went down there to visit her for a couple days and show her the new Toyota 4Runner. And, she had 40 acres. We all four got in, my stepdad, my brother, and my mom. And we just took a drive, did a little four wheeling on their property. And, at one point, we were kind of coming back, and I just look up, and there it was. And I'm like, do you guys see that? And, everybody saw it. They could tell what it was, that it was a UFO. We all kind of agreed on that. And it was pretty close to us, to be honest. And it was like metallic, and it kind of had a little, like a faint, like a dirty cloud around it kind of thing. And I immediately thought, oh, they must be using diesel fuel for propulsion.
Yeah, probably not. had anyone else in the family or you ever seen anything like that before?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
No, we never even had any interest in that or anything. You know, back in the 80s, it was a little rough, as you know.
I'm aware of that. It was a little rough, all right. I became, everybody knows what happened to me. I'm still here, though, boy, and so are you. So you see the UFO, and what do you do then? What happens then? Did it just disappear, or what happened to it?
Well, I had a camera. I had my first digital camera sitting on my lap. It was a Nikon Coolpix 950. Those are really cool cameras. But I didn't even – there's no way I could lift the camera up to take a picture of it.
No,
I didn't even think to ask anyone else to do it. I was just staring at it like, I don't want to stop looking at it or it's going to disappear. And then it sort of just it just faded away, disappeared.
Strange. It like faded out, like a dissolve in a movie, or it just suddenly was gone?
It's sort of a dissolve, yes.
Wow. Do you, if you ever had any sense of why it was there, why it showed up?
No, not at all.
You do know about the connections between our own dead and these UFOs and the visitors. There's all, that's all kind of wound up in the same ball of string.
I do. Now I do. I've learned quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. This sets you on a path, I'm sure, of more discovery.
Definitely curious, yeah.
And yeah. So what did you do then? I mean, what did the family do? Did you all talk about it? Or?
Well, I tried to talk to them about it, and they really were, they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to admit that they saw that, you know, and they just, I was like, whoa, this is crazy. We got to, you know, we got to do something here. We got to, you know, let's go figure something out. But, you know, I wanted to learn more. I was very curious after that. And I was a little upset with them that they were sort of like hush hush about it.
And they were, and over time, what happened? They just forgot about it, or what happened?
They just would never really, they just go, yeah, I remember that, you know, that kind of thing. And I think my brother one time said, yeah, I always thought that was just a weather balloon. I'm like, a weather balloon? Come on. It was it was way different than, you know, a balloon. And it seems like he had just heard that somewhere, maybe from, you know, the old Roswell excuses and stuff like that. But they were not into it like I was.
You know, the interesting thing is that these devices, they're, what was there was such an extraordinary thing. It chose you to add, activated you, but the others weren't needed, and so they were left unactivated, and it drifted out of their lives. Do you suppose they remember? I guess they still remember it, but only it's not important to them.
Yeah, it's just like a, you know, they saw like a deer or something on the side of the road. No big deal.
And yet, yeah, it was a big deal. Now, the next thing in the book, you begin to talk about spiritual exploration. And I don't recall, I'm not looking at the actual book at the moment. Is there a connection between the UFO sighting and the spiritual exploration that you began?
I think so, because I wasn't thinking about any of that prior to the UFO sighting. So almost immediately when I got home, I started really having an interest in Buddhism, which is, you know, it's not anything I'd been studying or had learned about as a child or anything like that. And I got aggressively searching for groups, meetups. I met a group of Tibetan Buddhist people in Denver, and I started taking some classes with them, and I learned the Hinayana and the Mahayana, and started doing some of the Vajrayana, and learned some Reiki, some of the healing stuff, and I did a couple past life regressions. I really went towards that type of stuff, which wasn't real normal for me prior.
What's interesting here is that you chose Tibetan Buddhism in particular, because Tibetan Buddhism, uniquely in the various Buddhist traditions, is the one most concentrated on the afterlife and on the different bardos, and the bardos of this life and the bardos of the afterlife, and these stages of being. And I just see the UFO coming and it specifically activates you in that car and nobody else. And then the next thing we know, you're on a spiritual journey toward a deeper understanding of the Virgo.
Yeah.
It's like they're saying, well, you know, you were supposed to come and you didn't, and now we're going to teach you what this is all about so that when you get, when it comes time again, you won't put up a fuss.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at it that way for sure.
Yeah. So now you get into past life regression. See, there's a fascinating arc here. This guy has a terrible accident, a near-death experience. He struggles for years building himself again, refuses to leave in the near-death experience when any fool would say, holy shit, thank God I'm out. And instead he comes back and he goes on this amazing journey. And that's why we're on the show together, because we want to know about these journeys, because there's not probably not a single listener who is not wanting to take a journey like this. And you know something about this kind of journey because you have been taken on your journey by a higher power. And yeah. Maybe you didn't look at it that way, but that's what happened. So you get into Tibetan Buddhism, but you then go beyond that. Let's talk about past life regressions and things like that. Why did you even think about getting a past life regression?
Well, I wanted to do all the stuff that was, the energy type work. They had this thing in Colorado, in Denver, called the Colorado Free University, and they would offer classes and stuff. And I got their catalog and I'm like, oh, what's this past life regression? What's this Reiki? Let's learn about. So I would go to these like introductions to these subjects, and you know, they would have people that would, you know, have books out or have services that, you know, they would kind of get your feet wet, so to speak, and they'd give you a little brief introduction on these things, and then I would go deeper. And what I did do a past life regression, and I honestly, when I went into the it was a kind of a group, there was four or five of us. And when I went in, I was like, okay, I'm not sure if this is going to work. And she said, at the end of our time here, we're going to all report what we saw and what happened. And so in my mind, immediately, I'm like, oh no, I got to come up with something right now. I'm going to tell them, I was a baseball player in the 1920s and I saw myself striking out or something like that. You know, I'm like, okay, I can tell them that. I didn't have much faith that it was going to work,
right.
You know, and we go into it and oh my God, all of a sudden I'm like, I'm in this world where everything is so clear and it just felt so real. I could feel the sun on my body. I could hear birds chirping. Everything was very peaceful. I was kind of looking down at my legs and I was above a battlefield, with just dead bodies and horses and blue and gray uniforms everywhere and, you know, swords and all kinds of stuff. But it was, the sun was shining. Everything was peaceful. It was so strange. I was up pretty high. And when I came out, you know, I reported to the group and the lady, her title was the Shift Guru, if I remember right. And she said, that sounds like you were in the American Civil War. And a lot of times people remember their most violent death. And it sounds like something, she thought maybe I was hanging because I was looking down at my feet from pretty high up. And that was one of my first experiences where, you know, it's not reality. It's like, but it's not like a dream, you know.
I think a lot of us have those experiences. It's not what they call a lucid dream. It's not reality. Yeah. At least it's not reality, this reality. And so where do you think you were? You think you were some soldier who got hanged or?
That's my conclusion. Yeah. Something.
Yeah. A lot of us have numerous lives that involve bad luck. I know I do. And you're right about the memories of past lives often being a violent deaths.
Yeah.
Like I remember dying in a chariot race in Rome. I was a charioteer and came around a bend too quickly, and that was it. And then another one where I'm very confused because I'm in a park with these palm trees, and they look fake. They don't look like real trees. And I'm very confused. And the next thing I know, a lion comes around the corner and grabs me under the shoulder here. I'm still, to this day, feel it. And I realize there's a roar, and I realize I'm in a crowded space, and this is all a set. And I'm being devoured, but the lion is no set. He's real. Then there's one about being gut shot back in 1945, and then one of catching on fire in an airplane in World War I. It's all... Then they're all like that. I mean, you know, where the unusual past life experiences are the ones where we remember a past life that had a quiet death, actually. Now, let's move on. We've got you. What's happened is your life has been reframed. The UFO sighting wasn't no accident. That was somebody who cares about you came to reframe your life, which is why you're here. Because as soon as I saw that part of your story, I don't think you fully understood what had happened, but that's what happened. Now, let me ask you this. If I just say to just let go and just riff on it, tell us what comes to mind about who may have been in that UFO, if anything. If nothing does, nothing does.
Oh, I feel like I'm part of a group of people that are participating in something that we're doing here. And when we're in our bodies, we don't really know that we're part of that. And I think the people in the tunnel of light and the beings in the craft, I feel like I'm related to them, like there's some sort of family. And I also, for some reason, I feel that when people that are close to me die, that they kind of go back to that group. That's just me speaking off the top of my head, kind of where I feel. I didn't really write that in the book, but.
No, but I recognize it immediately. What you're talking about is your soul group. This is one of the most interesting things about your story, is that normally the soul group is invisible. You don't see the soul group. And you don't experience the soul group while you're in this life. But like my wife said, after she passed on, it looks like you're all intentionally ignoring us. And we are. We are intentionally ignoring, because that's not why we're here. We're here to experience the new all the time, to get the wash of time passing over us. And every experience is new. And we're gathering energy from that. And this is a very important chance to be able to do this. And you don't want to look outside of the time stream, because when you do that, that's like being dead. your whole reason for being here ends. So your soul group is generally trying to maneuver you a little bit through the time stream so that you'll get the kinds of experiences that you want. And what's so unique in your case is you were ready to leave. They were ready for you to come. And you said you come back. And not only do you come back, you begin to build life lessons and a book that helps a lot of other people. This is a very energetic and heroic act on the part of your soul. You're not directly in touch with that now. It's because we're not in touch with that level of our being. But your soul, when you decided to come back, your soul knew what you would go through and decided to do it anyway. And that's another reason you're here, because I want that soul to be able to express it into the world what it came here to try to, it came back to try to express, because you've paid for this, man. You paid big. You're sitting there like that. So you can do this. I'm very much in admiration of you. I think you're a real hero.
Thank you, Willie.
So, okay. Now we go on. Here's you have a caregiver. Tell us about the caregiver and tell us what happened.
Which one?
The one who, the sudden absence.
The absence?
There were strange occurrences in the house.
Oh, yeah. During COVID, I had to cut down. I usually have 6 caregivers. I've had so many over the years. And I did talk about a few in the book. That's why I'm like, which one?
Oh, yeah. I understand. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I know which one you're talking about. During COVID, I cut down to 2 so that we wouldn't... in case someone got COVID, we wouldn't give it to everyone's families and stuff. And
right.
This gal, her name was April. She came to the interview and I said, tell me something about you that you want to tell me, And she goes, well, I guess I always wanted to see an alien. And she pulled her lip down. And she had an alien tattoo inside of her lip.
Oh my God.
And I was like, well, that's cool. Yeah. And, I told her I saw a UFO once. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to hire this one. I like her.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. So we went down the rabbit hole with any documentary, anything we could find during COVID. And we watched anything on YouTube, Netflix, Amazon, we got on Gaia TV and all that, and we just were soaking it all up while we were working, while she's working on me and stuff. We would watch this. We learned about CE5 and Stephen Greer, and so we started watching those documentaries he does, and we watched Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, and we got his app. And we would go out and sit out on the deck at night and play some of the binaural beat noises that are in there.
Yeah.
And look at the sky and stuff. And nothing happened. Nothing happened in the sky. But what was really peculiar was I noticed my dog was like sniffing around and doing like circles around on the deck. And I'm like, oh, that's weird. I've never seen that before. It felt like something was there, but it wasn't, UFOs coming in the sky like we were thinking would happen. We did that for like 2 weeks and we kind of gave up, not much happened. And then she would stay over here, and I have a guest bedroom for them, and she would put me in bed and then get me up in the morning. And when she was making me some breakfast, I went back out on the deck, and it's like 11 o'clock in the morning. And I look over to my right, and there's these three orbs just kind of loosely in a triangle formation, one on top, two on bottom. And they were kind of bouncing around, and I'm like, whoa, what is that? And they look like metal pinball kind of looking things. And the middle was sort of churning. It was almost like hypnotizing. It was really strange. And I'm like, April, get out here now. They didn't show up last night. They're here now. And she came out, and she was, you know, we watched them, and she's like, it was funny, Whitley, I'll tell you. She's like, I don't like it. I don't like them. I'm like, what do you mean you don't like them? She's and then she was acting like she was forgetting. She was having a hard time with it.
That's because it wasn't her soul group. And if it's not her soul group, she doesn't belong there. Now, speaking of belonging and not belonging, pre-Dreamlanders, I'm so sorry to tell you this because it's such a fabulous show. We got to say goodbye to you. Subscribe to the site. By some miracle you decide to do that, I would be very pleased. Thank you very much for being with us this week, and we'll see you again next week. So it could be that's the reason, and it could just be that it was too strange for her. So then what happens?
Let's see. I watched the three orbs go kind of in a horseshoe pattern over the top of my house. And so the sun is behind me rising, and they're in front of me at first. And I turn my wheelchair like 180, and I'm following them. I'm staring at them, not thinking about taking pictures or anything, just wanted to keep my eyes on them. And then they come all the way around. They pass the sun, and they come on the other side, and then they start blinking. And, you know, in my head, I'm like, oh, that's okay. They're telling me that, you know, they're definitely, you know, real. They're blinking, and it's not a reflection from the sun. That's immediately what I understood. And then I kind of felt like they were laughing. Like it was humorous for them. You know, that I'm like, whoa, I'm so mesmerized.
Yeah, because my guess is I've had that experience too, being sort of laughed at from the beyond. And yeah. I think it's because we're, to them, it's all so obvious and we get very overexcited. I think that's what it is. That's a guess.
Yeah, I don't even have a guess on that one. But it's definitely a feeling I get.
Yeah. Now, I wrote a question here. How did the sudden absence of the caregiver and the subsequent strange occurrences in your home affect your views on the supernatural? And that's from chapter 11, the caregiver crisis.
Oh, okay.
Do you remember that? Can you talk about that?
The absence, it might have been just that. She seemed to forget that we encountered that. That might have been what I was trying to say with that part. Maybe absent-minded or something.
Yeah, she had a bit of what you're trying to talk about was that she had a bit of amnesia.
Yeah. Maybe. Yes.
Yeah. I'm looking up the chapter now and trying to figure out what's going on.
And she's the one that wanted to see aliens, but
right. Well, I've found from experience that often the people who want to see aliens are the ones who don't want to see them when they do show up. okay. Let's see. My caregiver's frantic. Okay. I'll read the beginning of chapter 11. Maybe it'll jog your memory. Lying in bed, the morning light barely filtering through the curtains, I was jolted by my phone's urgent ring. My caregiver's voice crackled through the speaker, frantic and trembling with fear. "He's gone off the dam. I can't come in today." Her words hung in the air like a storm cloud, leaving me engulfed in sudden and unexpected chaos. Now, did that help? You remember that?
Yes, and I'm sorry, I jumped ahead in the story talking about April.
Could be, that's okay. We can jump ahead, and we can jump back, and we can jump off the cliff too when we do shows. We often do that. That's one of our favorite things.
Okay. Freestyle. So
let's roll into this story.
Okay. That happened a little bit, probably a couple months after I saw the UFO on my mom's ranch. So yeah, that was the caregiver. That caregiver, her boyfriend had crashed his motorcycle, and he actually passed that morning, and she couldn't come help me. And so when she did come back to work a couple weeks later, she was devastated by this accident. And as soon as she got here, she started kind of freaking out. And I remember we were in the bathroom. She was helping me wash my hands or something. And she started going, "I could smell his cologne all of a sudden." And then she acted like she could hear him or see him. And she starts going, "I'm fine. I'm okay. Leave me alone. You know, everything's fine." And then I'm like, "What's going on here?" You know, I was kind of shocked. And then my TV starts turning on and off. And she, that whole night, she was real weird. She was kept saying stuff out in the open. And then, so the guy that died was actually a garage door repairman. And then my garage door started going up and down. And I'm like, "Whoa, okay, we're communicating here."
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So that was new. That was something new after seeing that very first UFO.
Now, the experience of basically of him coming into, because he came into your house, and you know, there's all kinds of stuff here. Cold drafts wandering through the rooms like lost spirits. The TV's unpredictable performance. Obviously, something was going on. Yeah. He was there. And so you're right. The experience opened a door to a world I had never given much thought to before. Right. It made me wonder if there was more to my existence, a hidden ability to connect with those who had passed on. I found myself embracing this newfound curiosity. Now, can you tell us a little bit about where it has led?
Oh man, over all these years now, like there's all kinds of, I feel like there's all kinds of communication with people that have just passed, especially with certain electronic things in my house. There's a ceiling fan that one of my caregivers was helping me get out there and purchase this, and she picked it out at Home Depot, and I'm like, "Wow, that's the biggest, most expensive one." She's like, "You're getting that." And I'm like, "Okay, well, you know," she was very forceful, but I got it. And a couple of years later, she passed, you know, a pretty unfortunate accident. And almost immediately, that ceiling fan started turning on by itself. Just randomly.
Maybe not so randomly.
No, and as time went on, I noticed that it wasn't so randomly. It would be, you know, when we would talk about her, it would turn on. Various, it was pretty obvious to me that there was something else happening here.
Yeah. You begin to paint.
Yeah.
What drew you to painting? Because, folks, obviously, we're not talking about painting with hands. You tell us about how you paint.
Yeah, well, I was always a creative person. I like to draw, and I did a little painting before my accident. But when this happens to you, you know, it's kind of an insult to try to do things the way you used to.
Mm-hmm.
With your new paralyzed stuff, you know, it's not how you used to do it. So I would get really angry and kind of, you know, I developed the attitude, if I can't do it the way I used to, I don't want to do it at all. And then I saw someone on YouTube with a brush in their mouth. And I was like, you know, just because I can move my arms a little bit, that doesn't mean I can't put the brush in my mouth and try that. And when I did, I was able to get some good detail and control, and I was back, you know, I was creating again, and I started oil painting, and I've been doing that for about 8 years now. But yeah, it's pretty cool stuff. I do a lot of aliens and What's that?
I said, I wonder why that is.
Right. It's what I'm interested in.
Why are you interested in aliens?
I just...
Your life experience has been more with near-death stuff.
Yeah, well, just the UFO stuff. And I don't know. I'm interested in biology and what is this that we're doing here? You know what? You know, how did all this occur? You know, why are insects and, you know, really dangerous animals, why are they all smaller than us? You know, what's up with the scale here? How did this happen? You know, it could have happened a lot differently.
Well, also, you look at us and we don't have any hair. We've got huge brains by comparison to the other animals. I mean, really, our brains are much larger than their brains. And the way we live in the world is so completely, fantastically, and totally different. You have to ask yourself, are we aliens? You ever ask yourself that question?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think the answer is?
In my gut, I feel like we are created by aliens or some sort of other type of thing, and we might even be some sort of game happening here. You know, these are just my thoughts.
You never read my wife's books, Afterlife Revolution? I don't think. No,
I don't think I have. No.
The first things she said after she passed on and came recontacted me was, "Whitley, it's all a game." And I thought immediately, oh, shoot, I expected something more than a game. And she said, no, it's a serious game. So I think you're on the right track when you say it's a game.
I feel like it could even be like a competition between different types of aliens, maybe different races, almost like a open sourced human genome. And each one gets to take the basic genome and modify it, tinker with it, and put their version of the human down on the earth and see who either dominates or survives. Or, I mean, I feel that. I don't know why.
You've had an awful lot of, you're right at the edge. You're like a shaman now. This disaster was a shamanic initiation. And you're sort of, your book is bringing you into your role as a shaman. And let's go to the acupuncture table now. Remember this story? Suddenly a cold breeze, he's lying on the acupuncture table, folks, is full of needles and and he's been left alone in the room. It's quiet. Suddenly a cold breeze swept over me, freezing despite the warm room. And we all know that the presence of spirit often brings that coldness. It was followed by a low, guttural, demonic-sounding murmur, its words indecipherable, but its tone unmistakably menacing. I lay there frozen as I felt one of the needles from my upper back, where I still retained some sensation, dislodge and clatter softly onto the table. Now, this, I have to tell you, is the first incident I've ever heard of a poltergeist fooling around with an acupuncture needle. There's no other incident of that, in my opinion, in all the literature. So then the acupuncturist returns and something happens to you. You start to struggle.
Yeah, I noticed that my breathing was really labored, more than it is normally. And he would transfer me onto the table. Mm-hmm. And, when he sat me up, I was like, whoa, I couldn't really breathe. And, I try to be as tough as possible. And I'm like, okay, it'll go away. I'm not going to say anything. And he put me in the chair and I'm like, maybe when I get outside, I'll be able to breathe better. And, it didn't improve at all. But I got home and pretty much the whole day I was sort of, trying to take deep breaths and, go, come on, things are going to get better. Things are going to get better. And my evening caregiver came in and she's like, I'm like, I can't breathe that good. She's like, we're going to the emergency room. And we went to a small scale one, like in a strip mall over kind of by my house, and go in and, they did a lung, or they did an x-ray of my lungs. And the doctor comes in and says, well, your acupuncturist flattened your lung. It's collapsed. And I need to put a chest tube in. The nurses were like, whoa, hang on. We don't do that here. And, he's like, well, I'm doing it. And he turned around and he's looking through the equipment and he goes, who orders supplies around here? We don't have the right size for this guy. Cause I'm kind of small. And they're like, okay, even more of a reason to call, the paramedics, call the ambulance. We got to get him transferred over to the big hospital, which was about 10 minutes down the road, down the highway. And he's like, no, I'm doing it. And he put this thing in. I felt relief. I'm like, oh, okay, thank you. And then he called the ambulance and they got there and they took me to the big hospital. And I remember the next morning, the nurse coming in and sitting me up. Were asking me if I wanted to sit up to eat breakfast. And I was like, sure. And so she raised the headrest up and I started getting a little lightheaded. And she looks down at the ground and she turned pure white and freaked out and ran out of the room. And I'm like, I don't know why she did that.
And yeah, that's nice in the hospital with a nurse for sure.
Yeah, that's encouraging. So then I hear code blue, code blue. And just tons of people were coming into my room. All the different types of medical people. And they were measuring my blood pressure and it was dropping. And, they're like, one of the doctors got it down into my face and said, your chest tube has the doctor that put this in put the wrong size and the chest tube has clipped an artery between your ribs. And you're bleeding. You could bleed to death if we don't get this fixed right away. Then I started kind of getting a little delusional. I started seeing a really white, like plasma-like milky substance that everyone was kind of moving in and out of, and they were all doing anything they could to revive me. They were all taking turns, and they couldn't even get an IV. And after a while, my veins were rolling, and I was dehydrated. And that was interesting.
Yeah. As a nurse's simple offer to raise your bed, as you say in the book, became a journey into realization of the fragility of life. But here's the weird part, folks. Before this happened, what transpired in your mind about your will?
Oh, wait, was that, what part is that?
Well, no, before all of this happened, you had decided to become obsessed with the revising your will.
Yeah. I had...
Be careful with when I read these books. Be careful.
Yeah, you did read that. Was that in the part about where I almost... where we almost drove off the road?
Yeah, absolutely. But here's the thing that's fascinating is that you had just worked on the revision of the will before this happened, and yes. So you know it was like you were preparing for the possible your possible death, because you know ever since the first thing that happened to you, you have been a person who is involved with death and the near-death experience, understanding death, the world of the dead and the world of the living and the relationship between them. This is your life, and this is your message. This is a message in your book. Yeah. That's why you stayed here, why you returned, and why you're on this show. Because when I see someone with a soul mission, I know immediately what those are. And I brought you right on the show because I knew you had one. And I want that soul mission to be, give its chance to be heard by the world.
So have you found anyone else, though, that gets these weird feelings that they have to revise their will suddenly, and then a couple weeks later they almost die?
No, not in particular that. But that's not what the soul mission is. The soul mission, your soul mission is to have experiences like that, not necessarily that particular one, but just experiences like that, where there's a kind of a premonition or something like that. And the answer is on this show, a lot of people come on this show because I know how this works. I know how we're out on a stage and there's a curtain behind us. I know what's going on behind that curtain. And that's why I bring people like you on the show. You probably haven't even gotten too many shows, I wouldn't think. Because they don't know. They have no idea what's really going on here. They don't understand the world they live in. But I'm not in that situation. I do pretty much understand these things. So yeah.
Do, I'd say so.
Yeah. So now here's this. Let's talk about this milky plasma that you talk about, and first explain it, what it looked like, and then we're going to talk about what it was, okay?
Yeah, because I don't know what it was. I'm curious.
We'll talk about that.
Okay, yeah, it's really weird. One of the nurses had a ponytail and like these fluorescent blue glasses. And I could see those. I could see the ponytail whipping back and forth. And the glasses were really easy to follow along. And then, she would get like down like probably 3 inches from my face with her face. And then I could see her whole face, which I'm like, whoa, that's weird. That was weird. And she's like, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. This is great. You know, everything was fine. I wasn't panicking at all. They were all panicking big time. And then she would pull back and it just went into the blue sunglasses moving around. Or not sunglasses, just regular glasses. Other than that, let's see.
Then you saw that, but you saw this plasma, not just with that nurse, but a lot. The people in the room were all kind of, you could see this energy field in general.
Yeah, they were in it, you know?
Right.
It was around them, behind them.
As you ascend out of this level, and you're going to ascend, by the way, when you finally do die, which is a nice thing always, because a lot of people don't do that. A lot of people end up stuck on this plane because they're too heavy to ascend, and some of them are too heavy for this plane, and they go down, and that's awfully bad news. In any case, that's not going to happen to you. What you were looking at is you had already begun the process of ascension, and there's a kind of barrier between us. And if you look carefully in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you'll find this described in a different way between us and the living. And you were withdrawing, and you were seeing, you were just at the edge. And the thing that's so fascinating is almost nobody who's at that edge has got the consciousness or the presence of mind to actually see this. This is very rare what you saw there. And I was fascinated to know that you could see it. So know, folks, that there is an energy that surrounds all of us right now, that is the energy of life itself. And he was withdrawing from it and seeing it from the outside. It's a beautiful experience.
And it's comfortable.
Well, great. I'm glad of that, because we're all going to be there sooner or later.
I'm not afraid.
I wouldn't think so. Not after your life and what you've been through, and now the knowledge that you've done something quite wonderful. You said, what made you sit down to write all of this?
Just connecting the dots over time and sort of going, you know, because all these experiences are over 30, yeah, 30 something years. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. When we put all this together, it comes out into like this beautiful story.
Absolutely beautiful story.
Yeah.
Now, tell us about Julie and her passing.
Yeah. Julie Junebug was my second service dog that I had. She's a homemade service dog. I got her from I rescued her from a breeding program. She had had 20 puppies, and she was being retired. And so I took her and worked with her. She was such a cool dog. And we learned, you know, she learned how to pick stuff up for me and, you know, do various stuff that I need and just be a good dog and mind me when, you know, because I can't grab her and hold her back. You know, she would definitely listen. But I had her for 11 years, and she was getting older, and you know, that time comes when you got to take them in and put them down. She couldn't get up any longer. And, you know, I hadn't really experienced, you know, anyone in my family dying or anything. And, this was really hard for me, but, I chose to stay in the room when they did the injection. And I was holding her paw, and, you know, I expected to be devastated and, empty and, you know, just depressed. That's what my expectation was, but I wanted to be there for her, holding her hand, and she's looking at her paw, and she's looking at me like, okay, we're going to go home. And they put the injection in, and I mean, just shocked me. The feeling I got after when she did pass, it was like a giant, like a phoenix, like a bird, like an eagle. Like I get this red feel, this red, just, it's just screaming like, and it's taken off and it's going straight up, and it's just this ultimate freedom, like release of being this thing, you know? And it was like her spirit, I felt, that was moving on to be in something far greater. I was not depressed. I was actually just charged, full of energy after that.
Because you saw the truth?
I feel like it, yeah.
Yeah, you did. You've seen a lot of truth in your life, my friend. And there's another truth here. Sadly enough, folks, we've come to the end of this, pretty much the end of the show. A couple more minutes left. Matt, let me ask you this. Where are you with all this now? Where are you going? What are you doing? This
I feel like I should have some big, profound thing to say here.
The old souls don't usually have big, profound things to say, but what they do say is very important. So just tell us what you're doing. That's all we need to know.
Well, I mean, I'm completing this journey, you know? I feel like I've lived through all these things to learn something. And, you know, I'm just learning it. I'm going to ride this out, you know, and just continue to keep going. I'm going to try to write some more books and maybe do my audio book for this one. Maybe record it myself, read it myself.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing to do. It's very hard. I do it, but...
yeah, you do it well.
It's doable. It's doable. I have an audio engineer who is very, very strict. Now, Whitley, there's definitely a burp in there. There is no burp, Dan. There is a burp. And if you don't record it, I'm quitting. Anyway, thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And I think my audience does, because this is a very energetic experience to be with you, Matt. You have a beautiful soul and a courageous soul, because it wasn't your soul group who decided that you should stay. It was you. They were ready for you to come and rejoin them. You'd done it. But you said, no, I'm staying. And here you are giving all of us a wonderful energy, Matt. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, folks. What a show.
Wow. Yeah, that was fun. Thanks, Whitley.
Yeah, it was. It was great fun.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.